Listen to WGN Radio's newest podcast, Behind the Badge, Illinois, hosted by David Hochberg. Behind the Badge, Illinois views current events through the eyes of Illinois law enforcement leaders. Tune in. Visit WGNradio.com/behind the badge.
So, Brandon Johnson, mayor of Chicago, came up with an amazing font of wisdom the other day, the pearl of wisdom that just popped out of his head, fully formed. And it was about critics of Chicago, keep your mouth shut. Or better yet, keep your mouth shut. He's basically said, if you're not from Chicago, you have no right to say anything.
Let me make this emphatically clear. If you don't live in Chicago, you don't have a right to talk about the city of Chicago.
Well, bless him. You know, that's all I got to say. Bless him. While people in the CTA, riding the CTA, are being assaulted every day, while people can't find jobs, while other thugs are attacking people in the street, Johnson wants me to keep quiet. I know what happened. A day after I wrote that column on Johnson losing control and allowing all this to happen on the CTA, and would you ever let your daughter ride on the CTA, Mr. Johnson, was the column. And it went national. It was on Real Clear Politics and other sites nationally. He comes out and says, if you don't live in Chicago, keep your mouth shut. Well, guess what, Mayor? I'm sorry. I'm not going to keep my mouth shut. I'm going to keep talking. And better yet, I'm going to talk to somebody who else is not from Chicago but knows Chicago. He knows the Chicago way. His name is Nicholas Cass. My brother lives in Bucharest, Romania, far from Chicago, on the edge of the old Soviet Union. But years ago, as I remember him, clearly in Chicago, on the gritty streets of Gage Park, when they weren't gritty or dangerous, he was in the meat cooler of my father's store, and he was slugging sides of beef like Rocky to break their ribs like Rocky, because he had a big tournament coming up in karate. I remember that. And I think he wanted to fight Bill Thunderfoot Wallace, but he never got the chance, which always bothered him. But one thing that never got under my brother's skin was criticism by hack politicians. And so we're going to ask him about Johnson, about Chicago, and about, speaking of hack politicians who get paid off, how about the guy in the White House who is destroying the U.S.-NATO relationship right at the moment it needs to be strong, right at the moment that China is about to tip the apple cart. And if we ever needed a U.S.-NATO relationship, and why is Nick important and karate really doesn't have anything to do with it? It's because for 30 plus years, he spent in the U.S. government. He spent it in foreign policy, in the federal government, in the State Department, in Central Intelligence Agency, in briefing the President of the United States in early mornings, leaving his home at 2 o'clock, or maybe even earlier to get there by dawn. So I guess he spending a lot of time and years, in fact, in Turkey, in Ankara, and he's an expert in many things, foreign policy. So yeah, we're not talking to him just because he's my brother. It's because he knows what the bleep he's talking about. And as always, Jeff Carlin is here too, our buddy, mutual friend of me and Nick, friend of cats, friend of pies, and husband of dear Christine, who's had some health issues with feeling pain in her lower back, and we're hoping that she feels better. And everyone, please light a candle and think of those people who are less fortunate than you. And where are you with Jeff Carlin dealing with me and my brother Nick in Bucharest, Romania, where everybody seems to be a thick-necked driver for some reason? We'll get into that. Why is everyone a driver? You're on the Chicago Way podcast on WGN Plus.
So this is a guy who lives high on the hog, and he has this Tammany Hall-style attitude to power. And it's the Chicago way, absolutely.
Look, the Chicago way is a deep cultural phenomenon.
It's the Chicago way.
The Chicago way. That's the focus.
In a tower by the river, there lived a man. There was a man who took a stand. With pen and paper in his hand, defeating foes in every ward with a pen more mighty than the sword. No escape from his ink lasso. In a tower by the river, Castle.
Here's how you get him. He pulls a knife, you pull a gun. He sends one of yours to the hospital, you send one of his to the morgue. That's the Chicago way.
As promised, Nicholas J. Cass, foreign policy expert, U.S. State Department, former CIA analyst and briefer of presidents, briefer of speakers of houses, and not Mike Madigan either, but the real one. Nick, welcome to the Chicago Way podcast.
Thanks, John. Great to be here. Hi, Jeff. How are you?
Hey, Nick. Great to have you. Sound bright and clear from Memrania. I love it.
Thanks. Yeah, I know, John, I didn't fight Bill Wallace, but I did get a private fight in front of Masutatsu Oyama, which was a million times better. You know, we can talk about that some other time, maybe.
You know, just the idea that you got to fight and spar before Masuyama is like the, you know, biggest rock star thing in my
life. Pretty badass.
Yeah, it was badass because, you know, because we had a lot going. I mean, the honor of the dojo was at stake. And so my friend and training partner, Randy Van Loon, who was this huge muscular guy, just really, really good. We just like slugged it out. It was awesome. It was a lot of fun. But yeah, so that's the way it goes in those days. You know, anyway, good to be here, guys.
Well, Nick, and we're glad to have you because right, we're now coming up, I guess, more than a year since President Biden idiotically invited Russia to attack the land of Ukraine. And many people thought it would not last long, and it's lasted long because the American people and taxpayers are spending a lot of money there, building up the military of Ukraine and using products that they shouldn't be using and involving us deeper and deeper in debt and blood. But here's the problem as far as I'm concerned. At the same time this is going on, China is holding us in thorough contempt. China is mocking us and has been mocking us for a long time, since before Biden's terrible Afghanistan withdrawal, which led to the deaths of many Marines. And I'm wondering if there was ever a time when we needed, when we as the United States, Democrats and Republicans, needed a strong NATO, it would be now. But the Ukraine-Russia war and our mumbling policy, in my view, my own opinion, has led us to a situation where I think NATO is being threatened. What say you, Nick?
That's the big question, John. I think, you might recall, Jeff, that I think the first time we talked about this was before the war even started. And we brought up the idea of Mr. Creosote from Monty Python's Life of Brian, or from Meaning of Life, the guy who ate that last wafer and exploded, right? So Europe and the membership of NATO, the members are all complex countries. And altogether, there's even more complexity, and you have a lot of disagreement. And so when you're trying to manage a group of cats like that, you're trying to herd cats like that, first thing you have to do is do no harm. Focus on the members and try not to add other additional points of stress. And the unfortunate thing about the Ukraine war is that that is indeed causing stress that I think is becoming more and more evident. You're seeing some of the Western countries like France, for example, and the UK at completely different points. But you have a lot of other folks who are really worried. I mean, some countries in Eastern Europe, you know, they were happy to join NATO to protect themselves and protect others from the threat of a Russian attack. And the irony is that the way this Ukraine war has been handled is that it brings Russia into more direct conflict with NATO countries than it ever did before. And I think that this is just an extraordinarily badly mismanaged. We've seen now that as valiant as the Ukrainians have been in fighting, and putting aside their government's action, but just talking right. about the guys fighting.
They're tough people.
They're tough people. And but they're running into some very, very basic problems that are a result of Russia's innate military superiority in terms of population, in terms of resources it can bring to bear, artillery. I'm not a military expert, so I don't want to go too far down that lane. But as a strategic matter, I think you're seeing that, particularly since the loss at Bakhmut, and now we have this dam situation. Who knows what to make of it? I guess it'll all come out.
Well, let's talk about the dam. Yeah. Let's talk about the dam. So sure. Those who don't know, in the infighting between Russia and Ukraine, there has been many claims of atrocities and many claims of this news versus that news. And really, I can't believe it. I don't believe our own media anymore for the way they cover things. So there was an eruption at a dam in Ukraine that cools a nuclear reactor. And now without a nuclear reactor being cooled, you have a crisis. It's called a crisis and a meltdown in Three Miles Island and Chernobyl and all that. What's going on with that, Nick? Where's that going? And why? What's the reticence of the American news media not to want to explore it or report on it, just the way they don't want to report on Nazi symbols on the Ukrainian troops, tattoos. And there's something I just read the other day in one of the foreign policy magazines, a credible outfit, that said American journalists were basically editing the photographs and the images from the Ukrainians so that they didn't have to depict them with swastikas or SS signs on their arms. What's going on?
Well, I mean, I think that's a related but a separate question, and we should talk about that too. But let me just, on the Ukraine situation right now with the dam, my understanding is that the United States government is not really commenting much officially in either way, saying what's possible, what's not possible. And I think, you're obviously getting Ukrainians and Russians are throwing accusations back and forth. Some people are pointing out this seems to have been, if it was a Russian activity, it would seem to be not in the Russians' interest to do that. So, casting doubt on the theory that it was the Russians. Who knows? Who knows at this point? I think the main thing is just to stand by. And that actually might be one reason why the media has been so reluctant, because my impression of American media is that unless it's spoon-fed to them, it's very, very hard for them to understand almost anything these days. It's one of the greatest tragedies, I think, when you think about the state of democracy in the United States and you see the quality of the media that we have, I think it's extraordinary. And that, I think, affects everything. It affects the way in which we look at other countries. It affects not only the reporting on the war, but it reflects the reporting on, obviously, what the government does on internal matters, how we approach things, how we focus on things or not. I mean, they just refuse to look at certain things that seem to conflict with the preferred narrative. And I think that's a phenomenon that's being applied worldwide. And I see it from Romania. I can see that when it's applied to places that I know very, very well. And I can see that how that what passes for reportage or analysis is just a complete joke. And I think the consequence of that is that it conditions a public debate on issue X, Y, or Z at both the elite and at the popular level, which is completely devoid of any sense of what the realities are on the ground. And I think what we need right now, both in Ukraine and elsewhere, is a realistic understanding of what the actual situation is. So people will, I share your view about how we got here. It was a mistake. This should not have happened. But we are here now. And so then the question goes, what do we do? Well, in order to figure out what we need to do, we need to stop thinking ideologically. We need to start opening our eyes and focusing on the realities on the ground. And that will condition a lot of what's going on. This is not a good situation. But the longer it goes, the more pressure it puts on NATO. And I would say that the preservation of NATO and the security of the NATO allies, the actual guys who are in NATO, the treaty, those are the most important things. The rest of it, unfortunately, is not. And if there's something that's causing that a problem there, I think it behooves us to start thinking about how we address that. And so I hope that eventually some realism creeps into this. I know there is some debate publicly in Washington these days about frozen conflicts and all of that. And that might be certainly preferable to a situation where you continue fighting, many more innocent civilians and others die, and then you wind up in a situation that's either where you are now, which is the best case, or in a worst case. And again, we have to think about it from a humanitarian standpoint as well. I mean, this is getting ridiculous.
And that would look like something like the DMZ kind of. Is that what you're kind of alluding to? Like a shut it down. Let's see if we can figure this out.
The basic idea would be that this was not a resolved situation. Nobody has taken a backward step. But the reality is that, you know, people, possession being 9/10 of the law, you know, this is where the situation is. And then to start thinking about how we talk about this and extricate ourselves.
But can the American left, which is inexplicably glommed onto Ukraine with Ukrainian flags and all sorts, and viciously ignored the Ukrainian, I guess, zeitgeist.
Yeah.
How can they be expected to go along with the frozen status quo when that would basically and clearly point out that the Russians have won?
Well, I think that the bottom line on that calculus, I think that the domestic actors, political actors, are thinking of domestic politics.
Yes.
And so I imagine that there are many progressive interests that would see Ukraine as, you know, obviously they would not want to see Ukraine lose, but would accept it if indeed the alternative would be to call into question their participation on the sort of leadership coalition more broadly, because the game is really about maintaining the power to do what they want in the United States. And I think that's probably the calculation on all sides. I mean, people are thinking about what this means for me politically, and does this affect my ability to enact my agenda at home, where the real battle is? The war is just a means to an end, or
never enough. Never underestimate the potential cravenness of the American political class. But you have to help us out with one thing.
Sure.
Jeff, I want you to help Jeff and me and our listeners out with an understanding here. So with all this going on and all this conflicting, you know, propaganda back and forth, Ukrainians, the Russians, Putin. I mean, who believes Putin? I don't, but I don't believe the Ukrainians either.
Right.
So with all this going on back and forth, and the Democrats and screaming like the fellow from Maryland, Jamie Raskin, with that headcloth on, screaming. They're all screaming. What does Nick Cass read? Where does Nick Cass go for information?
Well, I mean, I would say for American journalists, I mean, I read a number of folks. I try to read guys on Real Clear, like Wegman and others, who do some really good reporting on, I think, the domestic situation.
Yeah, Phil
Bill Malugin, Julio Rojas, those kind of guys.
Yeah.
You know, I also read Matt Taibbi and, of course, Glenn Greenwald. I like Rod Dreher. I appreciate what he's writing about in Hungary, because I see a lot of similarities to the situation here in Romania.
Yes.
But then I also try, and I'm fortunate enough in the areas where I really care about to be able to read the papers in the vernacular. So I'm going to read Turkish and Kurdish newspapers, and you'll be surprised how much their analysis, their perception of reality is often quite far superior to what you get in the Acela corridor. So I think you just gotta, I think it takes a lot of work. It's really unfortunate because normal people have real lives and they're busy and they don't have time to sift through the wheat, through the chaff on all of these issues. And so they're reliant on a mainstream media that used to be, sort of at least had some sort of tends toward being somewhat more objective.
We had the luxury of believing that.
Yeah, but was it really ever that good? I mean, I don't know. In my lifetime, and I was born in the 80s. It's always been that, especially in foreign affairs. I mean, the idea of Wag the Dog and the first Desert Storm, and then the second. I mean, all those things were rife with BS from the media selling them as these great things. And then we look back, they were terrible. I think it's kind of been an illusion all along that we were, living in this bubble of pure American, in journalism.
I think there's something to be said for that. But I will also say that corresponded with a period, let's say, after the Vietnam War, when I was in university, where at DePaul, I went to DePaul, and I had professors who were avowed communists, right? Mm-hmm. Guys who were about as left as you could go, smart people, who were also very interested in actually hearing what I had to say, and not only that, but trying to help me develop my ideas, despite the fact that they might have disagreed. And so I think that was much more there was much more possible in the United States than it is now. Instead, what you get, I was just watching Chuck Todd, leave CBS or whatever he's at, saying something about how we never promoted ideology or like agendas. And I'm just like, dude,
are you
insane? I mean, I think there's almost like an insanity where people just don't recognize or aren't willing to recognize, or they are complete and utter prostitutes with no shame. I think there's a combination of that. It wasn't always the case. I think people were wrong back in the 80s or 70s to believe that everything was open. I think there was clearly an effort to kind of control the message, but there was not this animus toward actual exchange of ideas that you find now, which makes it impossible for people to explore things like...
The vitriol has certainly been amped up with the modern media, with TV TV and the internet, of course.
Or, Jeff, I think the bottom line is, back in the 80s, you would never not report things. I mean, they might report things and say, oh, Reagan said something crazy.
Right.
But now there's things like, the possibility of the director of the Federal Bureau of Investigation being held in contempt of court of Congress.
Yeah,
and it's people are like, oh, nothing to see here. So that tells you something about the nature of, we went through a 7-year period where President Trump was assaulted by media and, would call deep state elements, which were trying to overthrow him. For 6 years, and we just had reports about it, and I think the Durham report at least served to let people know that the whole thing was absolute poppycock from beginning to end, and corruption. Yet the mainstream media, nobody in the mainstream media is saying, this is a real issue, maybe it's a problem. And what you see is that being applied to every issue, whether it's foreign policy, some of the most ludicrous, childlike analysis of the situation out in the Ukraine, like in Turkey or in Kurdistan or in Europe, anywhere. You pick a spot. You pick a spot, and I can guarantee you that it's going to be the same kind of facile, lazy analysis that does a huge disservice to people. Huge disservice. And I think we're paying the price, and it's really it's very serious. And I didn't mean to speak in such an impassioned way, but no, I just find this as like,
Nick, we like passion.
Yeah,
right?
All good.
We're not those who freak out about passion. You know,
we don't wield lightly.
There's a red-blooded American in our midst. Oh my gosh!
Yeah, but you know, it's like
him.
Yeah. It's not. I mean, so there are a lot of people who will get that and they'll see it and they'll understand what we're talking about here. And there are a lot of people who will reject it, and I think the problem is trying to get to the people who reject that and say, "Don't you see? Can you not see what is going on? Can you not pause and think that what has been happening?" Over the last 6 or 7 years, when you have that level of mendacity on the part of politicians, but also elements of the security apparatus or, you know, the whatever. I mean, can you not see that there is a problem? And and this is a significant problem that has ramifications far beyond the current events here. I mean, it's horrible.
Yeah. We're bringing this around because all things are local. All politics is local.
Of course it is. Of course it is.
And we bring it back to Chicago and what you see of your hometown now that, you know, I remember I'm often criticized for daring to say something that maybe the left in its fever Twitter swamp might not like, you know, something of like the way Eric Zorn lives. I live rent-free in Eric Zorn's head, and he's constantly going through Twitter to find something that he might be able to use to cudgel me. It's like rather pathetic. It's
sad.
Sad, really. But yes, yeah. But well, we have a problem in Chicago, and that's our mayor. The mayor is saying, shut up, John Cass, or not me personally. If you don't live here, shut up. And I live happily in Indiana, the free state of Indiana.
Well, you mean he says, shut up, you have no right to talk unless your name is Soros? You know, is that how it works? Goodness. You can talk if you I'm sure, I mean, how much outside money does he and his colleagues accept? I mean, you pointed out quite often about Kim Fox taking money. I mean, last I heard, George Soros was not a, living in Highland Park or something, you know what I mean? He's living abroad or wherever the heck he is. I have no idea. So this is just ridiculous.
If you have national labor money, you can talk. But other than that, get out of his way.
Yeah.
It's embarrassing. And that clip, when we played it a little earlier, but it wasn't. Of the mayor. And the part, even before that, that kind of rubbed me the wrong way. I mean, I was expecting him to say something stupid. Like that, because he always tends to say these things. It sounds like he's got Obama's speechwriters working for him when he does this stuff. But
they're on acid when they're working for him. Yeah,
well, I don't know about that. I think they're just on like 100% oxygen, so they think they're gods. But the reality is that this guy is like talking about, well, you know, I'm a teacher. I don't know if you remember that. How could we forget? But he says that was his favorite job in the whole world, which I hope to be a teacher someday, and I can stand behind that. But that he goes on to say that except for the last 3 weeks have been terrible. Dude, you took the job. You spent millions of dollars and you can't just do it the right way. And just why are you're taking away our rights? Like if I'm not, don't live in the city, I don't have the right to say anything about it. Or if I work down here, I don't have a right. Or if I have a business down here, I apparently don't have a right. I mean, talk about, he's all about Mr. Inclusivity. That's the exact opposite. In fact, it's un-American because he's talking about taking away people's rights. And this is the guy who people say is the one who knows what's in all of our hearts and can find the good in all of us. And he can reach down and touch the youth of the city and raise them up unless they live on the other side of West or the other side of the city and they don't quite live in the boundary. I mean, it's ridiculous. And
they live in Oak Park.
Right. Exactly. And to your point, the media is touting this thing is like, oh, he's doing, you know, look at him. He's trying to get close to the cops. Cause that clip you heard was he was talking, addressing recent police graduates and trying to boost them up. And how disingenuous could you be?
Look, I mean, what's he going to do? I mean, well, let's look at it from his shoes though.
Sure.
What's he going to talk about? The CTA? He's going to talk about getting, I mean, you know, I live here in Bucharest, or as, you know, many people will say Bucharest out here. A lot of my English-speaking friends will say Bucharest. And, you know, I have a son who's 17 going on 18, and he'll say, you know, hey, I'm going to go explore the city. I'm just going to take the whatever. And I'm like, okay. And I don't, I mean, I, oh, you always worry as a parent, but you never, it's not like I'm thinking of, he's going off to the front lines. I'm not thinking that if he overstays or over misses his stop that he's in serious trouble.
Mm-hmm.
It's a civilized country, and I cannot tell you how great it is to be able to live in a place where that kind of fear, the fear of violence in your community, is just really, really almost negligible.
You mean live in a country where the criminals are scared and the citizens are happy?
Yeah,
instead of the opposite.
Exactly. And not only that, but it's like the social structure is so intact here that a lot of this would not occur. I mean, it wouldn't occur to people to do. I mean, it's just literally a different place. And, you know, used to be like that. But those days are long gone in the United States. And it's unfortunate that the mayor, instead of trying to address that and deal with that head forthrightly, is, you know, resorting to this kind of ludicrous, ridiculous, and what would be embarrassing rhetoric on this. So it's just, it's sad. And I feel sorry for everybody out there in Chicago, because it doesn't look like it's going to get any better anytime soon, guys.
It's not going to get better. It's going to have to bottom out. And as long as Tony Preckwinkle and Kim Fox are the architects of this decarceration movement and are not mentioned at all by the media that you mentioned, that has ceded editorial control to George Soros and his ilk.
Yeah.
Well, that means you're never going to see any real change in the lifetime of those political actors.
Yeah. It's the sound of a, it's like you always say, it's like the sound of a city dying. It's like a death rattle. And it's heartbreaking in a way. And the worst part is that people are just like frittering and blithering around while this is happening. You know, first get what's the slogan out there? First we get the money. is that real? Is that really what a slogan that's associated with
Chicago?
No, first we get the money. Where's that?
I think the slogan is "Shut up and take it."
Definitely that.
The people of the "Shut up and take it" crowd, they're not taking it, because every day I'm seeing more and more homes being built out here in Indiana, beautiful Northwest Indiana, where thousands of homes are being built for the overflow of refugees. And I think that when they come out here, what they're going to want is their schools to work, and their public safety, the public transportation to be safe, and the streets to be devoid of predators. I don't know. I think that's a radical concept here.
But that is a real thing. First, we get the money. And for those who may not have followed that, last month in May, the Johnson's transition team drew up a plan to raise $12 billion in new revenue. And the title of it was First We Get the Money.
You know, literally,
big bold letters.
The crassest bureaucrat in the Ceausescu era here would never have said that. I mean, maybe they didn't have to.
Right.
But but the idea that would be that kind of obvious. It's
for
just,
the edification of listeners who may not know. Could you tell us what happened to Nicolae Ceausescu?
Yeah, Nicolae Ceausescu was the communist dictator of Romania. And in 1989, he was giving a speech and found out nobody liked him anymore. He tried to escape. People turned him in. He had a one-hour trial, and I think some of his former associates, demonstrating that they were Democrats, pulled him out and shot him and killed him. And so it took
they wanted to prove,
we're not Democrats. With this guy.
Right.
Yeah,
we're you, not with them.
Right. Right. And so what happened for the poor Romanians was, of course, they had to deal with a lot of the aftermath of that. I mean, it was an extraordinary moment, the revolution. A lot of people actually died and put it on the line just so. And these guys were trying to obviously take over and keep it going under certain guise. But eventually, particularly about the last 20 years or so, you've seen, you know, obviously with their entry into the EU and entry into NATO, you've seen a lot of change here, and people are are serious now. You know, there's still a lot of problems here with the old mentality that continues to exist, but it's not communist as much. And the social and the actual the former Communist Party, the Social Democratic Party, is actually you know, pretty interesting when it comes to issues of religion, for example. I mean, they have you know, some very devout people in there, and it's actually one of the great ironies of life here.
Do they have the Dodgers? Are the Dodgers?
No, they do not have the Dodgers, but the patriarch here, you know, was pretty clear about his opposition to, you know, that kind of activity, shall we say, or that kind of that promotion of that kind of activity.
I don't want to bring up Pussy Riot, but that was the other country that was.
Yeah, well, you know, it's okay to. I guess you don't really have. Yeah, the extent to which you are a democracy is correlated to the extent to which you allow the desecration on the iconostasis. So, you know, I guess that's the standard in some places in the West.
Apparently, as the West devolves, contracts, and spasms its way into oblivion, I'm glad to know that Nicholas Cass, my brother, is out there thinking about these things.
Well, come on, Nick, I am
going to come out.
Yeah,
and we'll talk about that, but you know, not publicly. Okay, yeah, I wish I could bring everyone with me, but I can't.
Yeah. Before we go, Nick, I got to ask you something fun from the guys. So we're coming up on Father's Day, and obviously you guys both talk highly of your dad and have some great stories. But Nick, what do you got? Give me something. Give me a Cass brothers and dad, you know, going to a ball game or going to something. Give me a warm and fuzzy, as I like to tell the hosts I produce for.
Well, I don't know if it's like what day it was. Well, it was a winter time because we went to a hockey game. Mm-hmm. And this popped into my mind. And so, yes. So my dad got 4 box seats. Well, that's all we could get, you know, for some game. Sure. The Canadians or something, you know, Stan Mikita and Bobby Hall. Man, you know, when you walked into the stadium in those days, walked up the ramp and then you saw and you just heard the scream.
Oh, I love it.
Oh, my God.
And there was the smoke.
Yeah. There was the scream of the Canadians being beaten to a pulp on the ice by Bobby Hull. Yeah,
exactly. Right. So, you know, I remember just getting, you know, we went out to the game and, you know, we only could get 4 seats. And so we had 1 seat in the rafters. But we, you know, we all sat down together as a family, and I was a little guy. So I got to sit on my, you know, whatever, either on my dad's lap or, you know, squeezed next to John and Peter. And then, of course, some Andy Frayne guy saw us, and you know, nobody else gave us any problem. And then some other Andy Frayne came down and you know, sort of broke up that merriment. So my dad had to retreat up to the rafters. But yeah, it was interesting. Anyway, lots of them.
Those 10-2. The Blackhawks beat the Canadians and John Ferguson 10-2.
Les Habitants.
Because they pulled their goalie. They had to score a bunch of goals. They pulled their goalie. They knew they'd lost already. They pulled their goalie, and we just poured it on. It was so good.
I just remember another Bobby Hull thing with Ferguson where he was recovering from his broken jaw.
Yeah, yeah.
And he had a helmet, so he was getting weak. You know, he was physically wasn't as strong as he had been.
Wasn't eating.
Yeah, you know how that is. And he still fought Ferguson with a broken jaw and a helmet. So that guy was something else. He was great.
I love it. Well,
he used to sign his name Boover Hull.
Yeah, Boover Hull. That's right. I still have it. I have a Boover Hull signed card.
How you doing? You got it at the appliance store in Oakland. How you doing?
And then that stopped happening once that guy went to the meeting there and it wasn't any meeting.
Yeah, went to the meeting and then I ended up meeting a bunch of slugs from a 12-gauge shotgun and went through the window. Yeah. And how you doing? That's it. He ain't here no more. He's gone.
That was a big moment because Oak Lawn, you know, was such a mob town that, you know, my understanding
was the coppers were mobbed up.
And nobody wanted that kind of stuff happening in their neighborhood, right? So that's why they went there. But then it broke down, and I think that, you know,
What do you it all know? Started there.
It did.
Well, Nick, it's been great. Thanks for joining us.
My pleasure, guys. My pleasure.
Thanks, Nicky. For Nick Cass, former longtime official with the Department of State, the Central Intelligence Agency, other agencies, and my brother. And for Jeff Carlin and Christine, I'm going to put her in here, Jeff. Sorry. Love you, Christine. Hope you're feeling better. We're all praying for you. And for me, John Cass, editor-in-chief of John Cass News, writing my Sunday Father's Day column and writing a few more as I continue this rehabilitation journey. Thanks for joining us on the Chicago Way podcast on WGN+.